It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Everybody to the Elise Glink Show, live on Sundays 12 to 2. It's football season, so we're back an hour later. Get to sleep in an hour. Here on News Talk WSB, our number 404-872-0750. Or if you'd like me to pick up the cost of the call, you know I will. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time, the website thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. It's at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. When you're there, at thinklink.com, sign up for the free weekly newsletter. So I decided to invite a few of my favorite people on the show today to have some conversations about the economy, about college tuition, and how out of sight that thing's getting, the latest news on college scholarships. We're also going to talk with my good friend Liz Weston. She's got a brand new book out that answers your best questions. I think it's called something like There's No Dumb Question About Money, which I totally agree. And we're going to start with my old friend John Wasik, who has been a professional award-winning journalist speaker. He's written more books than I have. His latest book is called The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, which looks at the economic, cultural, environmental, and health problems underlying life in suburbia today, which plagues all of us here in Atlanta. John is also a blogger for Reuters. He writes and blogs for the Medicare News Group, near and dear to my heart, the New York Times, and Forbes, and you can find him on his website at johnwasik.net. But really, you can find him here. John, welcome back to the Elise Glink Show.
Well, thanks for having me back, Elise.
So recently the Fed, and I know this is a subject near and dear to your heart, the Fed decided that our rather anemic recovery, which they keep calling moderate, deserved a more substantial support, which they're going to call, or everybody else is going to call, the QE3, as if it's like the Queen Elizabeth's ship sailing across the ocean, which stands, of course, for quantitative easing, and it's the third round of it. And basically they're going to spend $85 billion a month trying to keep interest rates at 0%. At least that's my take on it. What do you think?
Well, it's hard to say if it's going to have all that much impact, because this is the last arrow in the Fed's quiver. They can't do anything more than this. Interest rates will drop incrementally and won't affect a lot of people. Corporate treasurers, of course, will like this because this will continue for another few years. Anybody who's trying to refinance will, of course, benefit because it will keep interest rates pretty low. But if you're a saver, if you're looking to cash in on this as if you were a big bank, and most people are not, it's not going to be terribly beneficial.
So why is it that I know the concept. The concept is if you keep interest rates at near zero, banks will make some money, and it's not going to cost them very much, and people will go out and borrow. They'll buy cars, they'll buy houses, they'll start businesses, they'll get loans. I know that's the thinking, right? Isn't that the high-level, super-secret thinking that's going on there? And yet, when you look out, because this isn't the first time the Fed has tried this. This has been going on now for several years. Is it working? It just doesn't seem to me to be working very well.
Well, it isn't. In terms of if you're looking at employment, which is still above 8%, if you're looking at the housing market, which is, it seems have bottomed out, but it's not exactly rebounding in a robust way. So it's not going to have a whole lot of impact on that, and there's some other structural problems there that need to be worked out that the Fed can't do. And there's the continuing problem of course, Europe and them figuring out their fiscal crisis, and, of course, the looming fiscal cliff, which I'm sure you've talked about a lot.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when I talk about the fiscal cliff on my show, you know, people have the most interesting responses to it because it's, you know, down in the South, there's a tremendous push to reduce the deficit, right? And people talk a lot about it. Radio talk show hosts on our very own station talk a lot about it. And what I try to do is say, well, we can just sort of slash and burn, and yet those are lots of jobs that are associated with those numbers. And so then you end up with another million, 2 million, 3 million people out of work, and it's not as if the unemployment numbers have been looking so great anyway. So it's kind of tough.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think they're going to let all those tax increases hit at once. They'll probably pass some sort of extension of the Bush era rates and then kind of deal with it next year after the election when the new Congress is in place. But in the meantime, it's causing a lot of anxiety. If you're a business, you don't want to plan for, say, raising your dividend. If the dividend rates are going to go up and it's going to be kind of a disincentive for people, you're looking at perhaps demand in the U.S. economy dropping off again, and we're just barely eking out 3% growth in GDP. So that's, you know, it's a huge, huge wall of anxiety that hasn't been surmounted, and Congress isn't really doing anything, you know, before the election, and they won't.
And the real issue is, are they going to do anything after the election? Because, you know, somebody's going to be elected, and then you're going to have, if it's Romney, he doesn't even take office until January 20-something this year, right? So, I think 20th or 21st. So you still have, you get past that January 1st date, and what did I see? That there's only, you know, maybe like 6 days left of Congress until the election? Or maybe if that many?
Yeah, I don't see anything really coming out of these few days before the election or much afterward. And traditionally, Congress hasn't really done that much in a lame duck session anyway. They leave all the big policy stuff until the new Congress is sworn in and we have somebody in the White House, whoever that might be. So we're looking at, you know, this huge age of uncertainty, which is going to last for a few months and drive everybody crazy. In the meantime, you know, a lot of the hot money is going to go into commodities and gold and silver and, you know, any number of things like copper and maybe even coal and oil, things that kind of move inversely to the dollar, because the dollar gets you know, taken down a few pegs whenever the Fed does these easing things. So that's the stuff that we can see now. But, you know, over the cliff, nobody knows.
Well, when you look at, I know you're working on a book about John Maynard Keynes, but when you look out on sort of where the ebb and flow of politics and economic money is, and you stand at such an interesting intersection, right? You've got Reuters, you've got Forbes, you're over in the Medicare space with Medicare News Group, New York Times, so you're standing in kind of an interesting space in four different media organizations that have very sort of specific points of view. What do you think what's your best guess? What do you think will happen? Because if we do nothing and we fall off the fiscal cliff, I think it's a guaranteed recession, right? And if we fix it, it could also be a guaranteed recession.
Well, I think it can be fixed, and I think it's going to be an incremental approach. It's going to be a very bloody battle. They'll have to agree to some sort of restructuring of the tax code. Maybe it won't be dramatic, but they'll have to look at some really basic issues. It's like, do you want capital gains and dividends rate to be at 15% instead of at the highest marginal rate? That's a basic policy decision that kind of separates the wheat from the chaff in a lot of this. Do you want rates to go up even though the economy is still struggling? I think that's a slam dunk. I don't think that's going to happen. Do you want a lot of deductions paired for corporations and perhaps wealthy individuals? That's maybe a little bit more negotiable. Maybe they'll go after a few and say, hey, we did tax reform, this is it for a while, and then they have to go on to the next big thing, which is Medicare reform, which will take years.
Right, and so I think it was the Congressional Budget Office came out and said if Romney gets into office and he actually enacts what he says he's going to enact and tries to roll back the Affordable Care Act, Medicare could go broke by 2016.
Well, first of all, on its face, that statement is unconstitutional because the president can't unilaterally get rid of a law like that without some sort of congressional interaction. He just can't, you know, get rid of it with one stroke of the pen. It just can't happen under our Constitution. But,
let's hope not.
You know, that doesn't mean it won't be discussed, because I'm sure it will. Then it will be discussed in the context of Medicare. Much of what the Affordable Care Act really started to do is to implement a Medicare reform template, which is to say we want to preserve most of the system. We're going to do it through internal cost savings. We're going to try to restructure payments to providers like doctors. We're going to try to curtail fraud, which is pretty rampant. It's like $50 billion a year at least. Do things like that, which needed to be done a long time ago. And the Affordable Care Act, to its credit, is addressing these issues. And if it's allowed to go forward, it will continue to deal with these things. And I think a lot of people need to realize that.
What do you hope will happen in 2013? And, you know, I know you spend a lot of your capital thinking about the housing market like I do. I've sort of said that this year is my turnaround year. I said it in January. I really feel like we're starting to have some traction. And we didn't see the summer like we have the last three summers, which was a tremendous rollback of whatever gains we'd made in the spring. So we're not actually bursting forward, but we're also 3 months or, you know, 2 weeks or whatever it is now in front of the presidential election, and traditionally in real estate, everything stops 2 to 3 months before a presidential election. But what do you look, when you look out over 2013, do you think super low interest rates are going to help? Do you think that the recovery is going to continue, or do you think, like I do, that until we really get jobs back in line, any real housing recovery is just going to be muted?
Well, I think the housing recovery will take several years. I think the damage that has been done will last for perhaps a generation, and there's a lot of things that need to be addressed. First of all, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac account for most of the mortgage market, and they're technically wards of the state. They were seized by the Treasury Department in 2008 during the meltdown, and somebody in Washington has to lay down a plan and go through with it, decide what to do with these two entities. Are we going to be backing up mortgages the way we did? Are we going to be selective and only back up, say, you know, smaller mortgages versus bigger mortgages? I mean, all these policy decisions have not even been dealt with, or they haven't made them public because we've been in an election season. So typically, an odd year starting the new presidential term is always the big policy year. If you're going to do a tax reform measure, if you're going to do a major policy thrust and clean up some stuff or make some huge changes, that's the year to do it. The pressure's kind of off. You know, you got another year until midterm elections, and it's not really critical for at least the presidential part of it.
So what you're doing is you're kind of putting all your eggs, and this is where health care reform went in. It was also in that first year, and that's where you have the most oomph.
Well, you also have the most political capital. You have a Congress. You know, power has changed hands in some way.
Right.
Maybe you have somebody new in the White House or somebody with a new agenda, but it's really kind of a new ball game if the, you know, the levers of power shift a little bit.
Right. We're talking with John Wasik. You can follow him on Twitter at John Wasik, J-O-H-N-W-A-S-I-K. John is the author of The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, which looks at life in suburbia. He's also at johnwasik.net, writes for Reuters, Forbes, Medicare News Group, New York Times. John, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Elise.
We'll speak to you soon. Stay tuned. If you are worried about college tuition, we have a wonderful person coming up. Lynn O'Shaughnessy is with us. She is a nationally recognized college expert. So stay tuned to the Elise Glink Show on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Elise Glink Show. Glad you're here with us today on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to check out my website. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. It's your portal to all things Glink. And if you're not following me on Twitter, you are missing more than half of the conversation. We tweet during the show. It's at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. It's time for our Real Estate Insight segment sponsored by Duffy Realty of Atlanta. Rhonda Duffy back with us. Hey, Rhonda.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Good show today.
Well, thanks so much. One thing that I always get asked is, how do you choose a good real estate agent? And I thought, you've been a real estate agent for a long time. In a prior life, you were a lawyer. You've been around the business forever. If you were picking an agent for yourself, buyer's agent or seller's agent, what are the qualities that you would look for?
I think more than the qualities, I think you have to look at the track record. Unfortunately, the public doesn't see the track record of an agent They have to believe the agent, right? They might have seen a sign in the neighborhood, or they go to church with them, whatever. And unfortunately, that's not good enough, because it's the experience of the contract or the experience of the transaction or the trend of what's happening that makes an agent good. So let me ask you, would you do business with an agent who's only done one or two transactions in the last 2 years? Is that enough for them to be making $10,000, $20,000 off of you?
Oh, I'm an agent's nightmare. I want an agent who has been in the business 10 or 15 or 20 years. I want them to have seen the housing stock come on and off the market forever. I want them to know why this house sold and this one didn't and what it sold for and the pricing. I want demographics. I'm too much work.
The 10 to 20 years, you don't mean 10 to 20 years of zero transactions.
No,
and unfortunately,
I mean,
an agent can hold a license that long,
right,
do their continuing ed, and say they're an agent. That's a problem.
It is a problem. I always like to match up what I'm looking for if I'm a buyer, right? So my age, what I'm looking for, price point, amenities, neighborhood, with the expertise of the agent. I want to know that they're out there actively working in that neighborhood, doing all those things, but match up. So if I'm a first-time buyer, I don't want to work with an agent who's doing million-dollar sales.
I want an agent who tells me, hey, this is who I represent until you hire me in writing.
So on your website today, you got a list of things I should look for?
Of course. RhondaDuffy.com. Posted it all out there. Seriously, sellers, buyers, get smart about this. This is a lot of money. You're paying a lot of money to someone to advise you. Get smart. RhondaDuffy.com.
Thanks so much, Rhonda. We will check in with you next week. I'm Elise Blink. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at ThinkGlink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Blink Show. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. My website, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. You know, up on today's blog, I have put all kinds of information about our guests today. We've got some very special guests. We talked to John Wasik. And with us now on the line is Lynn O'Shaughnessy. Lynn is nationally known for her work in the college space. She is a higher ed journalist, consultant, speaker. She's written a whole bunch of books. She has an Amazon bestseller out called The College Solution, a guide for everyone looking for the right school at the right price. And the second edition is out right now. She also writes the college blog for CBS Money Watch. So she's my colleague over there at moneywatch.com. And she is basically everywhere you want her to be when it comes to talking about college and tuition and costs and making it affordable. Lynn, thanks for coming back to the show.
Oh, sure. Thanks for inviting me, Elise.
So my son, Alex, is now a junior and has taken the ACT and is, you know, inundated with every day there's stuff coming in from colleges. And he got something the other day that I thought was completely inappropriate. Missouri State University, I'm calling you guys out if you're listening, they sent this little card. They don't know him. There's no previous relationship. And inside, right, one of my web producers said it looked like a kindergarten project. They had taken big fat markers and had like colored and wrote, you know, hey, Alex, you know, looking forward to seeing you at MSU, and a heart and the name of the person from the admissions office.
Well,
what's
you
that
know,
about?
Kids get a lot of crazy mailings from schools now because they're all trying to differentiate themselves. And, hey, you ended up talking about it, so, you know.
I did, although I'm not sure it's exactly the publicity they were hoping for.
It is a crazy time, and I got to say something about all those, all the stuff your son's getting, and all, you know, millions of other kids are getting. Part of one reason why there's so much mail going out is because schools want kids to apply to their school. Whether they actually want them to go to their school is another thing. Part of it is, and I've become very cynical covering the higher ed world, but some schools are sending materials to children that really don't qualify academically for their schools, just so these kids will apply, and then they get rejected. And then they look better because they're more selective because they're rejecting more kids.
It's just so disgusting. I'm sorry. It's just gross. All right. So college, wherever you go, is, you know, outrageously expensive, of course, except in Georgia if you get good grades, because then you get to go for basically free. But everywhere else in the country that I've been able to find, and if you don't go in Georgia, there are, it's pretty unaffordable. So right. I know one of the things you talk about all the time is how to make college more affordable. And when I talk about this topic, one of my favorite tips is to go to like a community college for a couple of years and transfer over, or a less expensive school and then transfer over. How does that work in the real world, and what other suggestions do you have for our listeners?
Well, you know, I mean, community college can be a good choice for some. The problem is that many of those kids don't end up graduating, getting four-year degrees. They somehow get stuck in the Bermuda Triangle of community colleges. That's not to say that some kids can't do very well there if you're motivated, but that's something to keep in mind. I mean, I think some ways to cut the cost of college is to not make common assumptions about the cost. For instance, I don't think you should assume that a state university is going to be less expensive than a private school, or you shouldn't assume that the price tag of any school means anything, because they are meaningless, because, you know, two-thirds of students in this country don't pay full price. So when you look at a school and say, wow, it's $50,000, you probably aren't going to pay that in the vast majority of cases. In some cases, you could pay, you know, a fraction of that. And also I think a way to reduce your cost is to don't try to apply to all the schools that everybody else is applying to, you know, broaden your net. And
how do you know where people are applying? Because it seems to me there are so many more college-bound students these days. Everybody's applying everywhere. I mean, the numbers are crazy.
Well, I mean, what I would look at is, you know, oftentimes when students, you know, want to go outside their state, I mean, they'll apply to the state school, and then they just have a, you know, there's a small number of schools that everybody feels like they have to go to, right? If you look at the dream list that Princeton Review comes out every year, it's, you know, the Ivy Leagues, it's Northwestern, it's Georgetown, NYU, USC, Berkeley, UCLA. You know, you apply to those, the schools that everyone else is applying to, yeah, you'll probably get rejected, and you're going to get frustrated. Whereas, you know, there's thousands of schools out there, and there's some wonderful schools that most people haven't heard of, but that certainly doesn't mean that you can't get as good at education, or in some many cases, a better education than going to some of the schools that everybody knows about.
How do you find these schools that are great but also offer, you know, generous packages? Because, you know, I know people up in Illinois who they get to, you know, University of Illinois is a great institution, but their kids are like, oh, I want to go to Michigan. Well, Michigan could cost you twice as much as the U of I. And
right.
Is that really worth it to go to a school
no,
like Michigan
or so.
U of
I? You know, I mean, a lot of these flagships, and that's what I'm talking about. If, you know, besides the ones I just mentioned, the, you know, the ones that everybody thinks they have to go to, then if they want to look elsewhere, they also put on their list other flagships in other states, like Michigan or Virginia or North Carolina or Wisconsin, right? They feel like, oh, you know, this is a premier school because everybody's heard of them.
Right.
But the thing is, applying to state universities when you're not a resident is, yeah, you are having more chance to get into those schools today. Or Berkeley, UCLA, right? They like non-resident kids because why? They're going to charge them a ton of money because they need the money. You know, all these state schools are desperate for more revenue. Where are you going to get it? You're going to get it from rich kids outside the state whose parents don't mind coughing up $40,000 or more. I mean, to go to a University of California school today, and if you want to go to Berkeley, you know, you got a better chance if you're not from California, but you're going to pay $54,000 a year.
I understand that even if you're from out of state, Caltech is still really hard to get into.
Oh, well, absolutely. But, you know, that is one of the most elite schools in the country.
Right, of course it is. It's like MIT of the West.
Pardon me?
It's MIT of the West.
Well, yeah, right. So, and plus, you have to be brilliant. I mean, I would not suggest that school.
I wouldn't get in personally, but...
Pardon
I'm
me?
Not that I'm not that form of brilliant, but yes.
Me neither.
So let's talk a little bit about, just before we run out of time, I want to make sure we get some of this in. You know, a lot of students are worried about, again, the money situation. I mean, these are just really tough times for most Americans. And financial aid has become, I think, just part of the package, right? So it's we hear a lot about student loans. We hear a lot about how this is the next bubble. Kids just get out of school. They can't get jobs. They can't pay for these loans. What do you sketch out? Sketch out for us a little of advice, and then I know I'm going to just send everybody to thecollegesolution.com, which is your website. But
right.
One thing
that people should absolutely do, and this is a really great tool that I think will empower families, is to use any school's net price calculator. This is something new. The federal government mandated it, and now every school must post on their website a net price calculator. You can use this. You have to type in information about your with your income tax return information and some of your assets. Some will require you to mention something about your child's GPA or SAT scores, ACT scores, that sort of thing. And once you plug all this in, you will get a personalized estimate of what that school is going to cost you, which is great because in the past, traditionally, when kids applied to schools, they had no idea if they were getting money from these schools, right, until they got the aid package usually in the spring or late winter when it was very close to having to make a decision. Now, I tell parents, and this is something that I talk about in my book and in my blog, don't let your kid finalize your college list until you've used the net price calculator to see what that school is going to cost you.
Mm-hmm.
That can help, you know, direct you to schools that are going to be more affordable and to run away from the really expensive schools.
Okay, so making sure you understand those costs, what if you find out the cost and it just, how do you know if that's even doable? Do you then go back to financial aid and say, okay, now I know it's going to cost me $62,000 a year to send my kid to Stanford. Now what?
Well, you know, I mean, you can't really start negotiating with schools unless you actually apply and get the financial aid package. Though, you know, the most elite schools in this country, like Stanford, they have excellent financial aid. Now, if you are wealthy and you're going to Stanford, the chances are you're going to get zero. You will pay, you know, close to $60,000. What's ironic is the most elite schools in the country give the best financial aid packages. They meet 100% of need, but they do not give typically any kind of scholarships to rich students because they don't have to because rich students flock to those schools.
Right, and they can afford it anyway. There's also a lot of international schools, students who go there who make a lot of money. One of the things I know you specialize in, and we just have a minute, on what families of divorce need to know about financial aid. Mm-hmm. What advice can you provide?
Well, if a family is applying or a child's applying to a school that just uses the FAFSA, the federal aid application, which most schools only use that one, then they're only going to ask about the finances of the custodial parent, which doesn't mean the parent who the judge says is custodial. It's the one where the child has lived the majority of the year. So if a child, let's say there's a doctor and a school teacher and there's a divorce, ideally the child will live with the school teacher who makes less money, and it's the school teacher's income that would be used for financial aid, and the doctor's income would not even be used at all because the doctor is not the custodial parent.
So you got to really think about who's living where and
yes,
with whom and all that.
Exactly. And you only have to live there, you know, 6 months and a day, right? You can live equally between the two as long as at least one more day a year you're with the parent who makes the least amount of money.
Right. And also if the two parents get along well enough to make sure that that's actually happening and one isn't trying to stick it to the other and... There's a few other little things that might go along there. We need to take a quick break, but when I come back, I want to talk about this idea that every parent thinks their kid is going to go play sports in college and it's going to solve all their problems. And I know you have some thoughts about that as well. We're talking with Lynn O'Shaughnessy. She is the guru on colleges and college expenses. She has written a great book called The College Solution, a guide for everyone looking for the right school at the right price. Second edition is out. Writes the college blog for CBS News and Money Watch. She's my colleague there. And her website, which is awesome, is thecollegesolution.com. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. We're going to come back and talk about athletic scholarships next here on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to to the Elise Glink Show. We're speaking with Lynn O'Shaughnessy. Her website, thecollegesolution.com. She's my colleague over at CBS Money Watch, where she writes all about colleges and expenses. So, Lynn, just before we went to break, I was asking you, or I wanted to ask you about the myths of athletic scholarships, mm-hmm. because since my boys have been in first grade, mm-hmm. they played on teams where parents seriously thought their kids were going to go to school on a college athletic scholarship. So what are some numbers about that? Just to bring everybody back to reality for a moment.
Yeah, right. And I do mention this in my book. But, yeah, I run into these parents all the time. Basically, there's very few athletic scholarships out there, you know, like less than 2% or about 2% of high school athletes in college get a scholarship. And to give you an example, there's like a million boys playing football in high school, and there's less than 29,000 college kids who get Division I or II football scholarships. The most popular sport for women is 600,000 girls in high school play, compete in track, and there's less than 10,000 athletic scholarships. So there isn't as much money as people would think. Frankly, it can be excellent to be an athlete because schools love athletes, but you don't have to get these scholarships, athletic scholarships. There's a lot of schools, say Division III, which has excellent schools. A lot of them are private schools, big name, brand name schools, and they offer merit money. So if you have a smart kid, I would suggest looking at schools that were actually going to be appropriate for your child academically, and most schools give academic scholarships to lots of kids, not just 4.0 kids. So you could play your sport. It won't be as high a level, but you won't have to devote as much time to your athleticism either.
Which is great.
Times Division I kids, you have to spend like 40 hours or more a week on.
Yeah, it's a job. I mean, let's just be really honest. It's an unpaid job,
yeah, exactly.
And they license your image for the rest of your life. And that's
right.
It makes me crazy. Lynn O'Shaughnessy is the author of The College Solution, a guide for everyone looking for the right school at the right price. The second edition is out now. If you've got a college-age kid like I do, and I have her book, it's great. Buy this book. You can get it online. Her website, thecollegesolution.com. Her blog over at CBS News Money Watch is fantastic. And you can follow her on Twitter at collegeblogs. And we'll have all of this up on the thinklink.com blog as well. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Elise. It was fun.
We'll do it again soon. All right, stay tuned. When we come back, we are going to go back to the economy and real estate. We're going to talk to Stan Humphries, who is the real estate economist for Zillow.com and does the Zestimate home value index and all this other kind of stuff. We're going to talk to him about what he thinks is really going on this year and how the rest of the year is going to play out. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. We'll be back with Stan Humphries next on News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Live on Sundays, we're now 12 to 2 here on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And I'm going to talk about this just a little bit, but we have a contest that you've heard me talk about the last couple of weeks. We're in the last week of it for the Equifax Finance blog. Tell us your story about how you manage your family's money, your best tips and tricks. Do it on video. Just hold up a flip cam, a handy cam. You don't need to be fancy about it. The very best video will win a $1,000 Discover gift card, and we want it to be you. And we also have lovely prizes for the finalists as well. It's free to enter. Get all of the details at blog.equifax.com. Or if you follow me on Twitter, I'm sure you've seen the link. We will send it out again this morning. We would love to have you join us. All right, right now, Stan Humphries, who is the chief economist for Zillow.com, joins us on the line. And he was just telling me during the break that he has become an incredible optimist about the real estate housing market, even here in Georgia. So, Stan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So I know that you claim that for the last 5 or 6 years you weren't an optimist, and now you are an optimist about the housing market. But where is this all this optimism coming from?
Well, I mean, you know, after just a really wrenching housing recession, I mean, home values have fallen about 22% from where they were at peak, and, you know, 5+ years of a housing recession. It's definitely been grueling on most Americans, but we do feel that we've now seen the market is beginning to turn a corner. We've now seen 8 months in a row of positive appreciation. We think that nationally home values bottomed latter part of last year in 2011, and we're seeing fairly strong appreciation, well, fairly strong for the recent past. We're up nationally about 1.2% home values are from where they were last year. Now, remember that even though we're feeling more bullish than we have in the past, generally we've been on the more bearish side around home forecasts. So even though we're feeling better, we still have fairly moderate expectations over the next few years because we think negative equity and foreclosures are going to cast a long shadow for a while.
Well, I think that's probably true. We've got the Fed that recently announced they're just going to, you know, QE3 is starting. They're just going to keep buying to the tune of about $85 billion a month. So they're going to keep mortgage interest rates really low as they can. That should help some. But I'm still concerned about all these people who are unemployed, underemployed, who got jobs and are making 30, 40 grand less than they were before. In my mind, you really can't have a robust housing recovery until these people get jobs and start getting paid better. What do you think?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, unemployment, really the two big pillars underlying, you know, that are going to be driving the housing market going forward are going to be what happens with unemployment and then what happens with negative equity. I mean, those are the two chief factors. And unemployment has played a huge role. And, of course, you know, with high levels of unemployment, you know, being above 8% right now nationally, you know, that tends to make people feel less certain about what's going to happen to their future jobs. And when they feel less certain about that, then they tend to hunker down and not want to extend themselves making a big purchase like a home sale. So that's been a big reason why, despite affordability being through the roof for the past year and a half to 2 years, people haven't gotten off the sidelines because of the uncertainty, as well as combined with the fact that home values are still falling very quickly during that period of time. So people, of course, don't want to go buy an asset that they think is going to lose a fair bit of value right after they buy it. And I think that's why in 2012 we've seen home buyers start to get off the fence a bit more, is that, one, we've seen a stabilization in home prices, so that's made them feel a little bit better about buying a home. And then, two, we've seen some modest improvement in both consumer confidence and in the unemployment numbers, and that's, depending on the month, really this year, home sales have been up anywhere from 5 to 12% from where they were last year, which is a decent amount of mainstream buyers getting off the fence again.
I want to be very clear that you don't mean home prices are up 5 to 12%. You just mean the number of sales.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And it's off a really, really low number.
That's exactly right. I mean, we were off, you know, during the recession, we've gone from, you know, selling at its peak, you know, almost 7 million homes a year down to
new and existing, right?
New and existing, that's right. Mm-hmm. Down to, you know, almost down to four and a half.
With the new homes being like zero, because it was about 230 or 260,000. It was under 300,000 2 years in a row, which was, yeah, basically, I think every real estate developer was playing dead.
That's exactly right. I mean, and there's just been a huge decimation of developers across the national landscape in terms of a much smaller number of builders who are in business now because of that.
Right. So there definitely is, you're hearing a sucking sound, so people are sucking up those properties. The developers went out, banks took them over, they resold the lots to other developers for a lot less money. In Atlanta, a market that has so much new development and literally lived off the fruit of that labor, both in terms of employment and housing sales for a very long time, far longer than just, you know, 3 or 4 years. I mean, this was, you know, a good decade or so in the making in Atlanta. I mean, you really are seeing people who now live in homes that they might have paid $250,000, $300,000 for, and the house next door is going to go on the market for about $150,000.
That's right. In Atlanta, has certainly seen you know very large home value declines. If you look you know, nationally, I mean, you've got markets like Miami and Phoenix that are down more from, you know, more than 50% from their peak, where it's just, you know, a stunning loss of home value. You know, across the, you know, through the end of 2011, we estimated that we lost more than $7 trillion in household wealth just by...
Wait, can you just say that number again? You have to say that number again. That's such an enormous number. Seven trillion?
More than $7 trillion in household wealth being erased just by the loss of equity in people's homes.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
I think when a lot of people think about, ask why is the broader economic recovery so slow, that's a big reason. I mean, you take $7 trillion of wealth off of households' balance sheets, and they naturally curtail spending in other areas in order to try to correct that. And that's a key reason why our broader economy has been slow to recover, is that people have been trying to deleverage and get their spending back in order.
One of the things that struck me a couple of weeks ago, we saw the numbers come out about the amount of credit card debt that people are using, and that number is falling. People are putting less on their credit cards, and of course, as the armchair economist that I have grown to be, I sit here and I talk to people every week, and it's so clear to me that, aside from the 1% or 5%, whatever number you want to put on it, the vast majority of Americans, if they are using their credit cards, are using them for everyday expenses that they just don't have the cash to front out. So that might be groceries, or it might be gasoline, or it might be things that they, if they could put their monthly rent payment or mortgage payment on their credit card, they might do that too in some ways. But yet the big ticket items, things that you might not need, like, the brand new Coach handbag for $700, that is not necessarily going on credit cards. What are you seeing in that respect as well?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that at last we are starting to see now credit scores nationally start to float up a little bit, and I think that's a consequence of the deleveraging that's happened on Americans' balance sheets really since 2008, when the broader economic recession set in, where they have tried to shed themselves of debt. Now, a lot of that shedding of debt, particularly for homeowners, has come through foreclosures and short selling and getting rid of mortgage debt, which, of course, has had some undesirable consequences of driving down home prices further. But a lot of that is also just through cutting back spending on credit cards and or living with their automobiles for a longer period of time. And right now in this country, the average age of the automobile is at an all-time high, just because people have not replaced cars at the same rate that they were before. So I think Americans have successfully now deleveraged a considerable amount. There may still be a little bit left to go, but I think we are seeing that now with credit scores beginning to float back up, where people look to be in more stable, secure footing with respect to their use of credit.
I know how I feel about this. I think that people's spending habits have changed forever, or at least as long as the Great Depression's changed spending habits, which we know for that generation was the rest of their lives, right? You had people in their 80s and 90s who remember what it was like to sell pencils and apples on the street corner and literally not have enough money to feed themselves. We've solved some of those problems, and I think I saw another report that said something like 20 million Americans were kept out of poverty during this last recession thanks to federal programs. But it seems to me that for this generation, there's got to be some lasting scars when you think it's gone on long enough. It wasn't like an 8-minute thing and then we had a commercial break, right? It's gone on a long, long time. And I'm wondering what your take is on this kind of semi-permanent or permanent scarring of at least some generation worth of Americans.
I think that people do have a new appreciation to be a bit more suspicious of. I mean, we've gone through there are asset bubbles in many countries in different eras, and we've had regional housing booms and busts. But this has been a particularly searing and very scarring one. So I think that people have probably a healthy suspicion now for bubbles start to develop, of being a bit suspicious whether this is actually going to last and whether they should participate in this or not, and also hopefully they have a better appreciation for the amount of leverage that a household ought to be taking on, making sure that they could they'd be able to ride out a downturn more easily, because I think a lot of the thinking that went on between really 2001 through 2006 or 2007 was that a downturn won't come, and therefore it's okay to get significantly out over your skis because you won't ever hit a bump.
There's no tree coming. Whatever they tell you, there's no tree coming. Just keep going down the path, right? Just keep going. It's all going to go up.
There's no mogul on this ski slope, and it turns out there are a lot of moguls.
This is sort of interesting. So earlier this summer, and my listeners know this, we took a drive through Toronto up to a zoo, the Bowmanville Zoo. It's one of the oldest zoos in Canada. And as I was driving through Toronto, I was just shocked at the number of cranes, building cranes, that dot the city. Clearly, Toronto and some parts of Western Canada are in an absolute massive overheated bubble, so much so that the Canadian government has just instituted a new rule that you actually have to have 20% down on a house or you can't buy it, something like that. I know there's been talk about forcing a 20% threshold, and I've been covering real estate long enough to remember when that was de rigueur, and you really couldn't buy a house with less than 20% down. Are we going to see, with what's happened with Fannie and Freddie and the $146 billion those guys owe us, the American taxpayer, do you think we're going to see a return to this kind of mandated down payment?
I think, you know, that really comes down to some really arcane legislation that will come out of the Dodd-Frank legislation that was passed through Congress relating to what's called a qualified residential mortgage. And, yes, the initial proposals coming out of the regulators was to create a credit box where basically anything that could be securitized had to have a 20% down payment. And, of course, securitization is most people, at least these days, want to have their mortgage product securitized. So that means that anything that wasn't securitized, and i.e. anything that didn't have a 20% down payment, would be at a significantly higher mortgage rate. Whether that's going to persist or not, I mean, basically that's kind of how the market is right now. Basically, you're either putting 20% down or you're getting an FHA mortgage right now, Federal Housing Administration mortgage. And the Federal Housing Administration mortgages are only going to, you know, they've really tightened up the credit scores and that are required there. So, now, over time, I think the Federal Housing Administration will ramp down. I mean, right now, they're anywhere from 30 to 50% of the market of
yes,
mortgage originations.
They're far above where they used to be. Far above, for sure.
Yep, and I think that will ramp down. And the question is whether we're left with some portion of the market that has to have 20% down, and then those who don't have 20% down are going to be paying a significantly higher mortgage rate, which is possible.
Although at these levels it doesn't matter, but it could matter if mortgage interest rates float up over the in the future once the Fed stops spending $85 billion a month, we don't know when that's going to be.
It also might push us into a direction in this country where people actually get more comfortable with adjustable rate mortgages, which if you look internationally, that's actually a more common way that people actually finance housing. And Americans, even though Americans only live in houses typically 5 to 7 years, they still seem to prefer 30-year mortgages, which the 30-year mortgage requires more securitization. I mean, it's much more of a longer-term proposition that people then will try to offload into the open markets to securitize.
We will have to continue that because I think there actually is some reason, I think, for people to look back at adjustable rate mortgages, but a lot of people who used them in the last 10 years got completely screwed when they went to refinance, and it was like, oh, Fannie and Freddie aren't securitizing those. You can't get any help now. You can't refinance, and you're 50% underwater. Dr. Stan Humphries is a real estate economist, chief economist for Zillow.com. You can learn more about his work at Zillow.com and follow his blog at Forbes, The Housing Theorem. Stan, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
Really appreciate it. All right, stay tuned. We've got Liz Weston coming up next. She is great, and she's got a new book out, and you're going to love it. I'm Elise Glink. This is the Elise Glink Show on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Coming up next, Liz Weston, our good friend from MSN.com, has a new book out. You are going to love it. It's called, and this is just perfect for me, There Are No Dumb Questions About Money. It is a collection of her Q&A columns. It's her first ebook. It is totally amazing, and she's going to join us to talk a little bit about that and some of the other personal finance quandaries that she has solved along the way, many of which you have as well. Stay tuned. I'm Elise Glink. This is AM 750. Now, 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Link Link Show. Our number 404-872-0750. Online all the time. The website, thinklink.com, thinklink.com. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and I will tweet you the link for today's blog, which has everybody's information, all these great people you've been hearing, with tips and links and names of their books and all the stuff that you're always asking me for, all up on the thinklink.com blog today. So you can go there and get it. And if you don't want to go there, just follow me on Twitter. We'll do that. And I want to remind you again, we still have another week or so to go of our Equifax Finance blog video contest. We want to hear from you how you solve your money woes and how you've managed your family's money. So it is our Family Money Matters video contest. You can get all the details and instructions by following me on @glink or go to blog.equifax.com. And let me remind you, $1,000 gift card is on the line from Discover Card. $1,000. 1000.00. $1,000. It's worth taking 5 minutes, making a video and telling us how you manage your money. We have other prizes for the other finalists. It's going to be great. So go to blog.equifax.com. All right. One of my very favorite people in the world, Liz Weston, joins us now. She is an award-winning, nationally syndicated personal finance columnist. She has won a Pulitzer Prize. She's like the only person I know personally who's done that. And she's written a whole bunch of great books. Her latest book is called The Ten Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. And her latest ebook, which is just out, released by Pearson, is called There Are No Dumb Questions About Money. It's available at Amazon and at iTunes. Liz, welcome back to the program.
Oh, it's great to be here, Elise.
All right, so you have a blog called AskLizWeston.com. That's your website, and you do these Q&A questions online. I write question and answer Q&As all the time. We take questions on the show. Are there really no dumb questions about money? I just want to know, because I don't get dumb questions. I get dumb comments. I get dumb, you know, postulations. I get all kinds of dumb things. Not questions, though.
Yeah, you know, and I used to think I did get dumb questions, and then I started to delve into them, and it's like, no, they're not really dumb. These are people, if they're asking the question, they're acknowledging that they don't know. And I think the bigger problem with people is that they think they do know. And this is a problem with personal finance columnists as well. I get in trouble when I think I know everything. And when we see dumb comments and we see people doing dumb things, which is very common, it's usually because they don't know what they don't know. So my whole premise for the book is all of us have to ask questions. None of us knows all of this. And the nice thing about being in my position, having written for the LA Times, writing now for MSN, I have access to some of the smartest people there are, and I can call them, and they'll actually call me back. When I have a question about taxes or estate planning or insurance or whatever, there are people who will help me out. And my hope is that people reading this book and people reading your stuff, you know, will know that there's help out there if they reach out for it.
So what are some of the questions? How did you divide up the book? Tell us a little bit about how you've organized the random, the seemingly random questions that you've included.
Well, you know, this is a collection of Q&As. It's already run in newspapers around the country. And I was like, well, why would anybody want to read that? Well, for one thing, I've organized them by topic. And I develop each topic from start to finish. And I expand on my original answers because, as you know, at least, there's not a lot of newspaper space, so you have to cram a lot in. In this book, I could stretch out, take my time, point people to other resources. You know, so we started with the basic stuff, started about, you know, how to create a spending plan that actually works, you know, how to figure out if you can afford something when you can't, moves on to credit issues, how to keep your credit good, why credit is important, credit scores, all that stuff. And then towards the back of the book, I start getting into the really fun stuff, which is the emotional stuff. It's how to talk to your partner about money, how to deal with your spendthrift sister, how to make sure your parents are protected from your greedy brother.
Listen, you know, I'm sure you've got some inheritance things in there as well, and that's a question that I get all the time.
Oh, yeah.
What do I do about the house we've inherited? My parents aren't going to leave me a house. What do I do about that? Or they are. I'm fighting with my siblings about our inheritance. What do we do there?
Yeah. It's very emotional stuff. It goes from 0 to 100 miles an hour in a very short time because we're reengaging with our original family, and a lot of the old patterns are still there.
Yep.
And there might be on top of that suspicions and anger and all kinds of stuff, and kind of sorting all these issues out and making reasonable choices at a time, a lot of times when we're dealing with our parents' decline and even death. it's just way more emotional than most people are prepared for, and things can really go wrong really fast.
You know, it's interesting. I find on this show more and more as we've gone through the summer and as things start to look like they're getting a little bit better out there economically, that people are having a hard time even trusting anymore. You know, the
yeah.
financial industry has gotten to a place, and I know I saw the statistic somewhere a few weeks ago where, you know, the number of people who have trust in our financial system and the banks and all the rest, that number is very low and dropping.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like people do have, first of all, they have trouble knowing who to trust and where to call to trust, but they're also having trouble just taking in and trusting information they are given, even from such trustworthy sources. So when you tell people to go places, let's maybe talk for a moment about how you vet those different places. Because I know I've been very honored you've sent people to my website, thinklink.com, over time, but you and I know each other for a long time. But when we go out in the world, what advice do you have for people in terms of vetting?
You know, I think one of the most important things is to look, well, credentials is part of it, all right? There are a lot of people out there in broadcast, on TV, in you know, blogging on the internet, who have absolutely no business giving financial advice. You know, maybe they know something about a small portion of finance, but they really don't have a comprehensive financial planning background. So I was just at a financial bloggers conference, and, you know, a bunch of 20 and 30-somethings for the most part, and I said, just because someone has a TV show does not mean they know about money. Just because you hear someone on the radio does
right.
not mean that they are a comprehensive financial planner. So the first thing I would do if I'm, you know, going to an individual for advice is to look for some credentials. If it's, you know, a tax pro, what kind of education do they have? What kind of ethics requirements do they have? Financial planners, same thing. That's why I gravitate to fee-only financial planners who are compensated only by fees from you, not by commissions or other arrangements. So to me, it's just a cleaner setup with there's always conflicts of interest, but fewer conflicts of interest in that kind of a setup.
You know, it's interesting when there are some financial planners who are on the radio, and you have to be careful there, too, because sometimes they, even though they're fee-only planners, it doesn't mean that they don't have another interest somewhere.
Yeah, and they may not know your situation, and that's the other thing, is that, you know, a lot of financial advice is very flexible, works well for, you know, different people in different situations, but there's also a component of financial planning that's very unique. You know, your situation is different from your neighbors, is different from, you know, your cousins, is different from, you know, whoever. So having someone who can look at your individual situation and give you advice, I think, is so much more helpful than taking generic advice, you know, from just anyone.
Do you find that there people have a hesitation to, and this is one of the things that I keep hearing over and over again, you know, how do I trust that financial planner? So what are some milestones or markers that you have when you're out there and you talk to different financial planners? Because just being fee-only, again, just being fee-only or having a CFP after your name, you think that that's okay. But, I mean, we keep seeing story after story about people who are not actually doing the right thing for you. And I think this is where those seeds of mistrust come from. I really
yeah,
feel very strongly.
Yeah, I think strongly. You more often hear about those kind of stories from folks that, you know, have that conflicted arrangement, that they're taking commissions where they're getting paid more to sell a certain product if you buy a certain product. But yeah, mm-hmm. any time you can run into problems with the lemon. So, you know, the CFP is the bottom line, the basic sort of credential I would look for. And then I'd look for, you know, what organizations is this person involved in? I've found that the financial planners that are part of NAPFA, which is the National Association for Personal Financial Advisors, NAPFA.org, tend to be really high quality. Now, I haven't met every single one of them and vetted every single one of them because I can't.
Because they're like 14,000 or 400,000 or some huge number.
There's definitely more than 1,000 of them now. There used to be quite a small group, but the NAPFA folks have pretty high ethical education and experience requirements. So now the problem is that they also tend to gravitate towards high net worth individuals.
Right.
So they may want you to invest like $250,000 with them. If you don't have $250,000 to invest, then I'd look at maybe Garrett Planning Network. They're the fee-only folks that charge by the hour.
I like them a lot.
Yeah, I've come across some really good people that way. You still have to do the interviews. You still have to vet them. you want to find out who their typical client is, because somebody who works primarily with teachers, for example, is going to have a different skill set from somebody who works primarily with entrepreneurs. So, you know, you may only have one in your area, so you may not have much choice, but if you do have some choice, you want somebody who is familiar with people in your situation. Another big one, do they have clients in retirement, not just approaching retirement or the accumulation phase? Because if you're going into retirement, you are making a lot of critical decisions. A lot of them you can't repair if you make the wrong one. So you really want somebody who's got experience in that area to be advising you.
You know who else I really like? The American Institute of CPAs, Certified Public Accountants.
Yes. Oh, and they have, we like those fiduciaries.
Right. They have a personal financial planning specialty now, a PF. I think they call it a PFS.
PFS, exactly.
Right, which is after, you know, so it's a CPA PFS. And you can get that one at AICPA.org, which is the American Institute of CPAs. In case you forget, just type in Institute CPAs and it'll pop right up. And it has a personal financial planning specialty, and you can search for that as well. And again, what's nice about it is that these are people who have gone through, I mean, to be a CPA, it is so hard. You have to go through so many tests and take so many, you know, years and years and years of accountancy courses and all the rest of it, and you have to stay up to date.
Mm-hmm.
That, in my mind, is another kind of credential that is really just a cut above, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mentioned fiduciary. Maybe not everybody knows what that is, but a fiduciary basically promises to put your interests ahead of his or her own. And that's the other thing I'd want from anybody who's giving me comprehensive financial planning advice. I would want, in writing, I am willing to be a fiduciary for you. I am willing to put your interests ahead of my own. Because that's a much higher legal standard than what most financial advisors have to abide by. Most financial advisors just have to prove that they are recommending suitable investments. And there can be a better investment. There can be one that's much lower cost. They don't have to mention it to you. So you want somebody who is actually putting your interests first, because then you are going to get better advice.
Which is so true. We're talking to Liz Weston. She's the author of a brand new book called There Are No Dumb Questions About Money. It is a collection of her award-winning question and answer columns. It's her first ebook. It was just released by Pearson. You can get it on Amazon.com or at iTunes. She's also written The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. And she has the website, AskLizWeston.com, and writes for MSN Money, among other places as well. Liz, can you stick around? I want to come back and ask you, what is the most asked question that you get? And compare
Absolutely.
Notes with you and see if that it's the same one as me.
Sounds good.
All right, stay tuned. We're going to come back and talk with Liz for another few minutes here on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, 404-872-0750, although I have to say we haven't gotten to many of your calls today. Liz Weston is on the phone with us. She is the author of The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy, and her newest book, it's an e-book. I love e-books. There Are No Dumb Questions About Money. It's a collection of her Q&A columns, far expanded beyond the original versions of them, and it is just released by Pearson. You can find it on Amazon or at iTunes, or get links to it. You can follow her on Twitter. AskLizWeston.com is her website. She's amazing. So, Liz, most asked question, what do you get?
How do I repair my trashed credit scores?
Oh, there are so many people.
In the old days, and, you know, like 5 years ago, it was because somebody went on a shopping spree, or they had huge medical bills and their scores were trashed. Now I'm hearing from people who have been through foreclosure, short sale. Okay, now how do I bounce back from this?
Right. And my most asked question is, my house is underwater. How do I refinance?
Okay. And what do you tell them?
What I tell them is, if you're lucky, you have an FHA loan or a VA loan, and you can do a streamlined FHA or a streamlined VA, you know, VA refinance, which I can send them links to, which are really the best because it just lowers your interest rate with almost no cost. Second best is you've got a Fannie or Freddie loan, and you can do a HARP refinance. Not all banks are doing them, but the big ones all are. And the worst is if you don't qualify for anything.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of people like that right now who still don't qualify for any sort of help whatsoever.
Yeah, and it's really hard to talk to those folks because, you know, one of the answers is simply walking away, and that's not the answer they want to hear or necessarily the advice we want to give. You know, we'd like to give people a better solution than that, and, you know, sometimes there just isn't one.
sometimes there isn't. Liz Weston has been amazing font of resource information, knowledge, all the rest. Pick up her new book. It's called There Are No Dumb Questions About Money, Amazon or at iTunes, and go to her website, AskLizWeston.com, and follow her on Twitter, @LizWeston. I do. You should, too. Liz, thanks so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
We'll talk again soon. I'm Elise Kling. Thanks for joining us today. You hear the music. That means our time is up. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. Enter the Equifax Finance Blog Contest, folks. $1,000 is on the line, and I want you to win it. Find out more at ThinkGlink.com. Have a great week, everybody. Everybody.